This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
This public radio podcast is supported by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services committed to environmentally sound, energy efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Are we or are we not? That is the question, and nobody really has an answer. We're all thinking the same thing, and the daily barrage of economic numbers would seem to confirm. So, are we in a recession? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. He's in Dubai preparing for our broadcast from the Middle East all next week. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the 7th day of March. We're probably not going to get an official declaration of recession until it's over. But that doesn't mean it isn't going to feel like one. And the employment figures released today only added to that feeling. The economy shed 63,000 jobs last month. That's the biggest drop in 5 years. And there are signs that a whole lot of people without jobs may have simply given up and stopped looking for one. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
February was the second month in a row the economy lost jobs, and job losses in January were worse than the government initially reported. Lindsay Piegza is an analyst at FTN Financial. She says we'd better get used to it.
Overall, there really is no sign of strength in any sector in the economy. So you can expect to see negative monthly reports for a good, I would say, 2 quarters. We're expecting to see negative growth for the next 4 to 6 quarters. So putting those together, we have a very grim picture for the economy.
Yesterday, the government released weekly figures for jobless claims. They were down, which means fewer people applied for unemployment. That's not necessarily a good sign, though, because it can indicate that people have given up on finding a job. That is, they've simply dropped out of the workforce. Christian Weller is a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. He says there's another equally ominous reason.
People know that they're losing a job. It will take some time before they can get a job back. They will delay asking for unemployment benefits until the last minute because they don't know how long they're going to be unemployed.
The weekly jobs claims numbers can fluctuate, but the 4-week average also fell. Weller says this downturn was bound to come as the economy enters what he calls a repayment phase. For years, it was cheap and easy to borrow money, which helped the economy grow. But now it's time, quite literally, to pay back those debts. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
There is, of course, one big job opening that won't be filled until November 4th. And now there's a controversy over whether two of the job candidates will get a do-over on their interviews. Michigan and Florida broke Democratic Party rules and held their primaries early, so were stripped of delegates. But the two states are now proving pivotal for both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton's chances of securing the nomination. There's talk now of having a re-vote. But the question of who would pay for it has everyone running for the exits. Jeremy Hobson has that story.
Let's start with Florida. A new primary there would cost about $25 million. But the Republican-run state is in the midst of cutting billions from its budget and says it won't pay. The Democratic National Committee says it can't afford it, and Alejandro Millar with the Florida Democratic Party says, "Don't look at me." And as far as the candidates splitting the cost?
Certainly that's not something that we want to do in, you know, asking them to commit millions and millions of dollars. You know, perhaps other donors might come to the forefront who want to resolve this bump in the road for the Democratic nomination.
Millar says the rich donor scenario would mean the Florida Democratic Party, not the state, would be the one putting on the primary. The cheaper alternatives are a caucus, which Millar says the state has no experience with and is
definitely not an option.
Or a vote by mail, which would still cost up to $10 million. That's about the same price as a new primary in Michigan, a state that isn't doing too well these days, if you hadn't heard. Here's the governor's press secretary, Liz Boyd.
Taxpayers will not be asked to pay for the cost of any redo for a primary they have already held in January.
What if a billionaire donor was willing to pay for it?
If a billionaire wanted to provide the money, I'm certain they could call the Michigan Democratic Party.
She laughs, but that scenario has now become about as likely as anything. The rules allow anyone to give as much as they want to a state party. Maybe Michael Bloomberg does have a role to play in this race after all. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
A study out of Chicago this week found that providing permanent housing for the homeless ultimately saves taxpayer money. It reduces demand for shelters, recovery programs, and hospital stays. Here in Los Angeles, the problem of homeless patients is so acute that hospitals have been caught dumping them on the city's Skid Row. Efforts to criminalize homeless patient dumping have thus far failed. Now, for the first time, a coalition is combining resources to address the problem. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
When you or I leave the hospital, we generally go home. That's not an option for the roughly 80,000 homeless people in Los Angeles County. They can't recuperate in shelters, which typically make residents leave during the day. And until today, there were only 45 beds available for homeless recuperation in L.A. County. So many homeless patients stay in acute care at great expense to the hospital.
$1,400 a day, and that is a conservative estimate from a community hospital perspective, but you go to some of the larger trauma centers, you could be looking at $3,000 to $4,000 a day.
That's Mark Gamble with the Hospital Association of Southern California. Today, he was at a Salvation Army shelter to unveil the new Recuperative Care Demonstration Project. It will provide 30 beds. It's important, Gamble says, because keeping the homeless in hospital beds isn't just expensive, but a bad use of resources.
Right now in Los Angeles County, we've had 10 hospitals close, and paramedics are driving all over the county looking for an open hospital bed.
A coalition of hospitals, philanthropies, and local government will cover the $5.5 million cost of the project. Bruce Chernoff is with the Department of Health Services in L.A. County.
In tight fiscal times, bringing departments and organizations together to provide services in a coordinated way is not only good for the families and clients, individuals being served, but it's also a really good use of both public and private funds.
15 more beds will be added later this year. If the pilot program is successful, the coalition plans to expand it. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, those payroll figures didn't give anyone a good start to the weekend. More on that when we talk to the guy down in Dallas. With stocks and bonds down in the dumps, commodities are at the top of investors' lists these days. Today's best example, oil. It set yet another price record, more than $106 a barrel. Other high flyers include wheat and copper and rice. Rice generally isn't a big deal here in the U.S. We produce less than 2% of the world's supply, and of that, only about a fifth is traded on a commodities exchange. But our little rice market is getting a lot of attention. And that has serious implications for countries where rice is an essential part of the food supply. From WBEZ in Chicago, Adrian Hill reports.
When it comes to commodities trading, rice is a niche market. You only need to look at the size of its trading pit. It's a small part of the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade, a really small part. The pit's just 10 feet by 10 feet.
There aren't that many of us. You know, there are only 10 guys. We don't need that much space. We're all pretty slim, so...
John Casey is the chairman of the Rice Pit Committee. He's been trading rice since 1988. Back then, a hundredweight of rice cost just $4. Last year, Casey traded it at $10.50. Today?
Could you hold on 1 second?
Casey makes a trade at more than $16 a hundredweight. When the price of anything rises this high, this fast, investors take notice. With some parts of the bond market frozen and the economy slowing, they want to find new places to put their money. Commodities like wheat, soy, and corn are in high demand now. Rice, too, but the market's so small that most people ignore it. Casey says that's created an opening for some adventurous investors, with hedge funds leading the way.
They have been extremely active. Some of these markets have doubled in price in the last 2 years. Many of the speculative hedge funds that look for those price swings have been in on this unbelievable historic rally.
We used to try to achieve about 1,000 contracts a day in the rice market, and now we're frequently trading 2,000, 3,000 contracts per day.
Dave Lehman is the director of commodity research at the CME Group. He says those contracts are agreements to buy or sell rice at a future date. More contracts mean more money, which keeps the system well-oiled, Lehman says.
When that liquidity grows, then the market is more efficient. Hedgers who need to use the market to manage their risk are able to enter and exit the market more efficiently at a lower cost as this liquidity expands.
There is a downside to all that money sloshing around the market. It can push prices artificially high. James Barnett is a grain analyst with MF Global Research. He says hedge funds and other investors are indulging in speculation.
And the prices are higher than current supply-demand tells you they would be. But there's a good reason for it. The speculative buying reflects what we're seeing in the big picture.
These speculators think rice prices will keep rising. They're betting on a weak dollar, competition with other crops for land, tightening global supply and rising demand. There's no law against making that bet, but there's only so much investment the fledgling market can handle.
The thing to remember for rice is, again, it's a small market in the U.S. It definitely provides opportunities to trade, but it can only absorb so much speculative interest before it quits functioning as an active market reflecting real prices in the real world.
The danger is prices on the exchange could spike. Chicago's rice market is used as a price benchmark around the world, so inflated prices here could hurt countries that depend on rice as a primary food source. In Chicago, I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson in Dallas. Happy Friday, David.
Oh, happy
yeah,
happy Friday.
Not that happy, huh?
No. I'm serious when I say that. First of all, I'm glad that it's over with, but I'm glad this market only dropped 146 points. Because if you told me yesterday that we were going to have job losses coming out of the government of the magnitude that we did, 63,000, on top of more job losses being heaped on the January figure, and if the logical conclusion is that we're in a recession, you know, I really thought we'd be down 300 or 400 points.
Is there any amount of loss in the stock market that would actually shake you?
Oh,
150 points, and you're saying woohoo?
No, I could. Well, believe me, I can be shaken. I could. I remember October of '87, but no. I mean, on the one hand, you kind of want something like that. You one thing we always look for, all the stock market guys look for, is some sort of a purge. Get it out of your system. You know, a lot of volume, have a hard sell-off, and then you can come back. You have these relatively small sell-offs, you can go on forever.
And it feels like we've had a couple of those in the last year. You know, you had the big Shanghai dip back about a year ago, and then in August we had a big fall on the Dow. And we came back from both of those, but honestly, I'm looking at my 401k, and it just gets worse and worse and worse now.
It's like a 301k. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But you know, the problem is it's not the stock market. I mean, I really am bold enough to think I could figure this out if it were just the stock market. It's the wild card out there. This is not a stock market problem. This is a credit market problem. And it started way back with the subprimes, and it's way beyond the subprimes right now. And so now you got a bunch of stock market guys, me included, you know, being forced to figure out all these stupid acronyms, these CMOs and CDOs. And so this is a real challenge right now, is to try to figure out how low is low.
Tell me if I'm wrong here, but it feels like there's some new revelation every day that the market goes, Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that that was out there. I better panic. But you look at what it's actually talking about, and it's just more of the same bad news every day.
Well, except that it really has grown. I mean, it started. Think of it as just, you know, the proverbial dominoes. And I guess the first domino way back there was a subprime business.
Yeah.
And it just keeps going and going and going. And this was why this propping up this AMBAC, this bond insurer, was so important. And I think we were so disappointed in it. It's done, but maybe not to the degree that we hoped. Because all that really was one of a series of dominoes that have fallen. But if you think about that domino theory, what you need to do is go in there, and if you can just prop up one or two of those dominoes, that it's going to have the impact of propping back up some other dominoes, and you're going to get some confidence back in this thing. Well, you know, we end this week lower for the week and without the confidence we need. Maybe we need an architect to get these dominoes up instead of an economist.
Oh, well, on that positive note, thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Tess.
David Johnson in Dallas. Coming up, Chinese investment under the global microscope.
It's a learning process for them. They basically realize that things will not work outside of China the same way as things work inside China.
But first, let's do the numbers. That woeful jobs report sent stocks reeling today. The Dow dropped 1.2%. As David mentioned, that's 146 points to close at 11,893. The Nasdaq slipped 0.3%, 8 points to close at 2212. The S&P gave back 0.8%, 10 points to end the day at 1293. For the week, the Dow tumbled 3%. The Nasdaq moved down 2.6%. The S&P was off 2.8%. An analyst downgrade crushed Alcoa. Its shares dropped more than 4.5%. Washington Mutual debited almost 9% after Standard & Poor's cut its rating to triple B, just two steps above junk status. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, President Bush meets with the Prime Minister of Poland. The FAA discusses congestion and environmental issues at its annual Aviation Forecast Conference. And the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame honors inductees in New York. Leonard Cohen, Madonna, and John Mellencamp are some of the names that made the list. Artists aren't eligible until 25 years after their first recording was released. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal, who's on assignment in Dubai. Cue the photographers for yet another round of CEOs holding up their right hands, swearing to tell the truth before a congressional hearing. This time, it isn't about corporate malfeasance per se. Instead, three CEOs from financial companies were grilled about why they made piles of money even while presiding over massive corporate losses because of the subprime crisis. Marketplace's John Dimsdale was there.
Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and the nation's largest mortgage lender, Countrywide Financial, lost a combined total of over $20 billion in the last half of 2007. During that year, Charles Prince resigned from Citigroup with a $40 million package. Merrill Lynch gave Stanley O'Neill a $160 million package. And the CEO of Countrywide, Angelo Mozzillo, received over $120 million. Committee Chairman, California Democrat Henry Waxman, wondered why, in light of steep subprime losses, CEO pay was so extraordinary.
Any reasonable relation between their compensation and the interests of their shareholders appears to have been broken down.
Waxman wanted to know why Mozillo speeded up selling his company stock in 2006, just as Countrywide's stock price hit its peak. Mozillo said the sales were merely in preparation for his impending retirement.
I was with the company 40 years. Almost all of my net worth was in Countrywide. I had to come to a point of diversifying my investments and my assets.
Virginia Republican Tom Davis accused Democrats of holding a public flogging of corporate executives. He said markets sometimes produce inequities, but they also correct them.
The last thing union pension funds and other investors want is Congress second-guessing and micromanaging the people looking after their money.
This was the committee's second hearing on executive compensation. So far, there are no plans for more. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
As John mentioned, two of the three CEOs on Capitol Hill today did lose their jobs. That meant the boards of Merrill Lynch and Citigroup had to find replacements. That's never an easy task. Commentator and management expert Joseph Bauer says when it comes to finding successors for their top executives, corporations have a lot to learn.
Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Time Warner have all struggled in the last month to get through the instability caused by CEO succession. It's not surprising. Continuity in management is one of the most effective ways to sustain exceptional performance over the long term. Yet we are seeing shorter tenures for CEOs and more outsiders being chosen for the job over inside candidates. This despite the fact that on average, insiders do a superior job, whether performance has been better than average or worse. In fact, insiders do better more reliably when performance is worse. So why the outsiders? Because when the time comes for succession, the incumbent often looks inside and concludes that no one is good enough to succeed me. Or the board sees poor performance and blames all the insiders. At that point, an anxious board turns to a search firm and says, "Get us a star no matter what the price." What companies really need is what I call an inside outsider. That is an outstanding inside performer who has retained his or her objectivity. They have the energy, ambition, and intellectual integrity. They see the magnitude of change needed, and because they are insiders, they can move quickly with a real chance of success because they know the people, systems, culture, and assets of the company. Why aren't there more candidates like this available? To begin, a surprising number of companies don't have a real succession process. They treat succession as an uncomfortable event. Managing the development of leaders inside the company requires investment in every aspect of the way the firm is managed. Who is recruited, how businesses are organized, how executives are paid and promoted, and how operations are planned and resources allocated. The process requires years, not days, of preparation. Companies need to change their ways on CEO succession or pay a price that goes far beyond the new CEO's compensation package.
Joseph Bauer teaches at Harvard Business School. His most recent book is The CEO Within, Why Inside Outsiders Are the Key to Succession Planning. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. China is investing its vast foreign reserves around the world in African oil projects, U.S. banks, and infrastructure projects in Southeast Asia. But in the Philippines, Beijing is facing tough questions about alleged kickbacks and bribery in a number of major contracts. Filipinos have protested in the streets, and the Congress there summoned Chinese execs to testify about questionable deals. The growing scandal is threatening the presidency of Gloria Arroyo. From Manila, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Clark Airfield, north of Manila, once stood as the largest U.S. military base in the world, housing 30,000 forces. 17 years ago, the U.S. and the Philippines agreed to close the base and remake it into a Philippine economic zone. Among the key investors were the Chinese.
Right now, we're on our new 18-hole golf course. It's the first 18 of 36.
Tony Biggs runs Fontana Leisure Parks, a Chinese resort catering to Asian tourists.
From Shanghai, Guangzhou, Beijing, they love to come here.
Chinese money is also bankrolling a rail line linking Clark to Manila and its 16 million people. It's called North Rail, and Beijing has pledged $500 million in loans for it. Philippine President Gloria Arroyo hailed the deal as part of a golden era with China. Here she is in a 2006 speech talking about ASEAN, Southeast Asia's regional trading bloc.
I am very proud that among China's trade with all the countries of ASEAN, the fastest growing trade is China's trade with the Philippines.
Beijing is investing in projects across the region, in Burma, Vietnam, Indonesia, all places with natural resources that China covets in return. But the Philippine North Rail project is mired in controversy. Not a single track has been laid. Attorney Harry Roque advises the Philippine Congress.
The contract is illegal because, among others, it did not undergo any competitive bidding.
He says the Chinese lender broke Philippine law when it picked which contractor would get the job, a Chinese contractor.
While American and European companies have to comply with anti-corruption principles, the Chinese, I should say, are completely ignoring these tools of transparency and accountability, and that is what worries them.
And in his view, here's the larger problem. China is like the giant new bank in town, lending only to its friends, no questions asked.
Senator Enrile, would you like to make use of your 3 minutes?
North Rail isn't the only Chinese-funded project facing corruption questions. There are at least four. Senator Alan Cayetano heads the investigations.
Truly, it is the year of the rat, and here in the Senate, we smell big rats.
Still, not everyone sees a Chinese master plan here. Peking University international relations scholar Zhang Xizheng sees rookie mistakes.
China has been developing so fast. Its companies just got rich, and they think they have all this economic power, but they don't understand market rules and laws, so it's almost inevitable they broke them.
Political scientist Renato De Castro believes the Chinese were also unprepared for Manila's mudslinging politicians and its nosy journalists.
It's a learning process for them. They basically realize that things will not work outside of China the same way as things work inside China.
For the record, Chinese officials blame the scandals on Philippine politicians. Wherever the investigations go, De Castro sees a lot at stake here, both for Beijing and for Washington.
Number one.
91.5.
On the surface, the American influence here seems obvious. Just hop in a cab and listen to the radio. But De Castro says while China is doling out economic favors, Washington is distracted.
Since the U.S. has been focused on the war on terror, there seems to be on the part of the U.S., a benign neglect in the region.
China has committed some $2 billion to the Philippines, but the Arroyo government has frozen most of those projects pending corruption hearings. The North Rail investigation may resume within a month. In Manila, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, our economy may be on the skids, but if you're a top executive, as we've mentioned, you might well be in good shape. Proxy filings this week showed off nice returns for the folks in charge. Just today, Goldman Sachs reported that CEO Lloyd Blankfein earned about $100 million in total compensation last year. If you're thinking that maybe the boss needs to take his pay scale elsewhere,
sell your boss at yellowjobs.com.
Try promoting him or her on this Indian career network. You can basically try to sell your CEO, put their resume up. If they're hired away, you get paid. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow heaved off 146 points, 1 2/10%. The Nasdaq fell 8 points, 1/3%. The S&P dropped 10 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Join us next week for our special coverage from Dubai. It's The Middle East at Work. And on Monday, Kai gives us a tour of the Vegas of the Persian Gulf.
We have been catapulted to this modern world from really the Bronze Age. If you were here 40 years ago, you would not have electricity or medical service. or whatever.
I'm Tess Viglin. Don't forget to spring ahead this weekend and have a good one.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.